Next case is number 23-1047, Jamal Morton versus Director of Bridger Island's Bureau of Corrections. Mr. Lay? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes. Good morning. May it please the court, Daniel Lay on behalf of appellant Jamal Morton. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Five or max?
I'm sorry. All I will reserve the 5 minutes, please.
Got it.
If the circumstances of this case don't merit federal habeas review under Section 2254, it is almost impossible to think of what would happen. The appellant in his local territorial habeas case did everything expected, did everything right to move the case forward, and to no avail.
After this status conference, he could have sent a letter to the judge saying, where's our schedule order, right?
I suppose so. I'm not sure.
He could have filed a mandamus petition in the Supreme Court as well to get the Superior Court moving, right?
He could have.
Was he familiar with mandamus petitions?
I can't speak to that.
You don't know whether your client had ever filed mandamus petitions in the past? That's not on the record?
I believe he had in different situations.
So if he had, he's familiar with mandamus petitions, right?
Your Honor, I'm not. In general, yes. If there is different context, different circumstances in different contexts, like getting a habeas petition adjudicated, I'm not sure if he was familiar with those elements. But in general, yes.
Again, I'm not suggesting what happened here wasn't a travesty on the part of the territorial court. I don't know what the delay was. Do you have any insights into why this case sat for so long? We're almost about a decade now.
That's correct, and absolutely no idea, Your Honor. I think that's one of the most troubling things about what happened and, of course, the district court's ruling. As you know, it was 6 years before he filed his federal habeas petition. It was 3 years after the hearing, the status conference hearing that you had just referenced, where the judge said he was going to take action that will move the case along, favorable action for the petitioner. The appellant here.
Is that like the issue of writ meant? Is that, it seemed a little ambiguous to me. I wasn't sure what that meant. But your understanding was when the court at the status conference said I'm going to issue a writ that meant granting the state the territorial habeas petition.
My understanding, especially because it was alongside the statement that he issue a briefing schedule, is that he was finding that the petition was procedurally valid, not frivolous, and could move forward. He also had, as you know, approximately a year after filing the petition was fully briefed. Even with the USVI's belated response, and then the appellant moved to strike affirmative defenses, and then the appellant filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings, which was a dispositive motion that, instead of issuing the writ and a scheduling order, my understanding is that the court could have ruled on that, and if it was in favor of the petitioner, it would be done. So,
Mr. Lader, if we looked at the first 3 years, even with those fits and starts and the government missing some deadlines, at the end of those first 3 years, you wouldn't be arguing that at that point he had exhausted just because it had taken 3 years to get to that point, right? The case was moving forward, albeit slowly.
Well, the case moved forward only on the action of the litigants, not the court, until the status hearing, and it appeared that the court was going to take action to move the case forward. But as we know, 3 years after that came and went, and nothing happened.
Well, that's my question, because those first 3 years, the case that seems to be moving forward, albeit slowly, then there's the status conference, and for the next 3 years, nothing happens, but it's furthering Judge Hartman's question, those 3 years, the petitioner didn't do anything. Can we say, looking at the 3 years of silence, that he took the steps he needed to exhaust?
I would say absolutely, Judge. I think that the timeline of events makes it clear. The petition was filed in 2014. Approximately a year later, it was fully briefed, and the petitioner filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings that if he won, would end everything. It's literally everything that you could do at that point. I'm not saying that after that 1 year, that would have been exhausted. I'm saying everything that you could expect a habeas petitioner to do had been done. After all those motions were pending, another year went by, no action. So the petitioner filed a motion for a status conference. And that was granted, but it was another year before that hearing even held.
So those first 3 years, things move forward. But then there's supposed to be a briefing schedule, and there isn't one. And the petitioner doesn't take any steps at all to move things forward for 3 years.
But that's because he already had. He already had, and it took a year to get the status hearing. He got the court to say on the record that it was going to issue the writ. It's not going to dismiss the case for some procedural want. He said the court said it's going to issue the writ and it's going to issue a briefing schedule. And yes, the court did that. The case would be moving forward. And to emphasize this, the question is how long after that should he have waited to take any of the actions that the district court said he possibly could? A motion to enforce the statement on the record? I'm not even sure when you use ECF, what you would tag that as.
Well, something we see with regularity, with great regularity I've seen over years with prisoner litigation, is a letter from the prisoner saying, hello, status of my case, I haven't heard anything. I mean, I've seen hundreds of those letters. It seems a little peculiar that he waited 3 years because when a judge says, I'm going to issue a scheduling order, that's a routine act. You're not waiting for a 50-page opinion on motion for judgment of pleadings. You're waiting for a simple scheduling order. So after a month, 2 months, 3 months, it would have been relatively easy for your client to toss a letter over saying, whatever happened to my scheduling order? What's going on with my case, Judge?
Your Honor, that's correct. But first of all, the court also said it was going to rule on the other pending motions at the time, which is not something that you can say, do this, and it's a ministerial act, which is the purpose of filing a writ of mandates.
What's your best case for his not having to do anything more than he did?
Your Honor, I haven't found a single case where a district court has dismissed for lack of exhaustion or finding that the process wasn't effective, or an appeals court affirmed that dismissal, saying, yeah, you did a lot, but you should have done more. Every single case I found has been, you didn't do anything, and you could have done something. And something is a whole different thing than nothing. Or you actually went out of your way to prolong this, and the reason that it's been 5 years is because you refused to come into the jurisdiction when you were out for 3 years.
But isn't the standard that in order to avoid, let me step back from it, you would concede, would you not, that EDPA requires exhaustion before going to federal court?
Yes, but the term exhaustion has been broadly defined and includes in either exhaustion or a demonstration that the process is ineffective to protect the rights.
Right, the process has to be unavailable. If basically, to use layman's phrase, if the state process, if there's a breakdown in the state process such that state process is unavailable, then you can go to federal court. Isn't that the standard?
I don't believe so. There are three different avenues. There's exhaustion, where you go through the normal course, or there is under 2254B1.
All right, well, we know we don't have exhaustion, and we don't have A, and then we have B1, which says there's an absence of available state corrective process.
And that doesn't apply here.
That doesn't apply here. We're dealing with B2, right?
Yes.
Circumstances exist that render such process ineffective to protect the rights of the applicant. So what does it mean for the process to be ineffective? We said that in the Lee case, or at least we noted in the Lee case, that there, Mr. Lee did all that could reasonably be expected to pursue his claim in state court. And I'm wondering here, can we say the same thing about Mr. Morton? Has he done what could reasonably have been expected to pursue his territorial court remedies before going to federal court?
Absolutely.
And so you think it was unreasonable? It would be unreasonable for us to say that he should have poked, again, to use a colloquial word, they should have poked the Superior Court and said, you know, what's going on with my case?
I do. I think it's unreasonable.
That's too much to ask.
I believe so, because consider the motion for a status conference, which is essentially a counseled professional version of your mentioning the letter from the prisoner. And he filed that, and it was another year since that hearing occurred. So after the hearing, how long is he supposed to wait? 1 year, and then file another motion for a status conference, and then wait another year to have that hearing? I think that is a breakdown of the process that effectively entitles him to federal habeas review at that point.
Should we be deciding this as a matter of what the categorical rule is for the requirement of seeking habeas, seeking a mandamus to exhaust on habeas, or taking some further step when the court has said it's going to rule? Or can we take account of the individualized circumstances? Here, for example, let's assume that your client has filed in the past at least 3 mandamus petitions. So one can tell from the record that he's familiar with mandamus on the one hand. Should we take account of that? What significance does that have on the one hand? And on the other, can we take account of the fact that with delays that seem to often happen in these kinds of cases, unfortunately, in the Virgin Islands, that mandamus petitions have been successful when directed at the Virgin Islands Supreme Court, which has then responded to them?
I think this scenario, you have to do an ad hoc analysis in general. And I don't believe the fact that the petitioner had filed other mandamus should play any part in this. Because as far as I understand, filing mandamus in other situations was not part of the exhaustion of remedies, which is the statutory requirement we're looking at here. And I would argue that saying that a mandamus petition is essentially a required element in the Virgin Islands shows that the process is ineffective.
If we find an ordinate delay, wouldn't the case law support remand to give the government an opportunity to tell us why this inordinate delay should not excuse the exhaustion?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's a glaring error of law in the decision below that needs to be corrected. I would argue that the circumstances here are clear enough that there is no justification, and reversal with and remand with instructions to consider on the merits is warranted.
Well, but the government never had an opportunity to do that. Wouldn't you concede we really need to do that?
Yes, I would agree that would be the appropriate remedy to require the state to meet its burden.
All right, thank you. You have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Whitaker. Mr. Cutter. Mr. Clement, I'm sorry to jump right in. Sometimes this happens.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Assistant Attorney General Ian Clement on behalf of the respondent, Appellees.
Thank you. Thank you. Could you start with Judge Rendell's question? Because isn't the law clear that once there's an inordinate delay, the burden shifts to the government to show why the exhaustion was not required? Or was, why exhaustion was required?
If the district court finds an order to delay, but the district court found that that Mr. Morton had contributed to that delay, so there was no.
Well, he contributed to the delay after the status conference. That was the final.
Right. And
why? But boy, speaking only for myself, there seemed to be an inordinate delay in getting to the status conference, wasn't there?
There was delay, Your Honor, but that does not warrant an exhaustion in this case. And I would say.
No, I know. I'm not there yet.
Right.
What I'm saying is suggesting, and you tell me what I'm missing, is that because there was such a delay up to the status conference, and Mr. Morton was doing, he was doing his part before the status conference. He was very active trying to move the case along before the status conference, correct?
Correct, but the government does not concede that there was inordinate delay as compared to any other case in the Virgin Islands. There was delay, it was moved.
As compared to any other case in the Virgin Islands or any other case generally? I mean, we have held that 33 months is an inordinate delay. How long do you think the delay was in this case?
No, we're talking about before the status conference or after the status conference.
The whole thing. It's at what to well, today. I mean, as all right, before the status conference.
All right, so there was a year period where things didn't happen, but the case had, at that point, at the point of the status conference, it was moving, and if I could place this in historical context. So on July 19th, 2017, there was a status conference, and the court says, I'm going to issue the writ, meaning I'm going to have a scheduling order the government to write its return, you can write a traverse, and so on.
But wasn't there 6 years up till then? Was it 6 years?
No, it was 3 years until then.
3 years until then. And right. Then 3 years afterwards.
Right.
So it was 6 years total.
Yes, Your Honor. And so 50 days later, September 5th, the territory was hit with a devastating hurricane, Hurricane Irma. 2 weeks after that, we had another hurricane, Hurricane Maria. The entire court system, the territorial court system.
Aren't these reasons why, if it goes back, you get to argue that the six-year delay is not a basis for excusing exhaustion because of all these other factors? Isn't that where that comes in?
If the court rules that way, these are reasons that the government could put up.
That you would present,
yes.
In the court. What case would support the proposition that petitioner had to do something more here? I mean, the Virgin Islands court acted like he contributed to the delay, but he didn't really do anything to cause it. Maybe he didn't do X, Y, or Z, or did prod, as Judge Hardiman referenced, but what case says he had to do something more than he did?
After the status conference, I would say Barksdale v. Krause, 360 Federal 2nd 34, 10th Circuit, 1966. And that talks about the lack of diligence of petitioner's counsel.
Well, a case from another circuit that was decided 30 years before EDPA was decided.
Right.
That's pretty.
Is it? I have not pulled that case. That's in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Were facts similar to here, that he had done something and then failed to do something else, just inaction, or what were the facts of that case?
I would have to submit something further on that for you. I just rereading it. I'm just.
Don't we have case law? A story says that you don't need to tell the court that it hasn't acted. That you don't would indicate under our case law. You really don't have to tell the court that it has failed to do what it's obligated to do.
I am unaware of that, Your Honor. But Your Honor, I would say this. In this particular circumstance, I would say that with the situation with the hurricane, and then in 2020 with COVID, right? In the spring of that year, the court system again shut down. And a series of emergency orders was issued. The Supreme Court ordered on March 18th, 2020,
that all previously scheduled court proceedings, whether civil, criminal, on or before any judicial officer in any judicial branch facility, shall be continued without date, and no new proceeding scheduled, limiting exceptions like advice of rights, would be initiated. The court also said that judges had the discretion to hold a remote hearing via teleconferencing, Zoom, whatever, upon motion by a party. Mr. Morton, his counsel, they never motioned for any type of remote hearing.
All right, where did the district court emphasize either the hurricane or COVID?
These things were not presented on the record. And right at that point in time, Your Honor, the Attorney General had not been served. That the magistrate and the district court denied Mr. Morton's motion to serve the Attorney General at that point.
Of course, these are things.
No, that's a good answer for why there's no fault on the part of your office.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it seems to be a further indictment of the district court's opinion here, because if you've given us now in this court good reasons to explain the delay, then the district court should have cited those good reasons. And when there is inordinate delay, the burden shifts to the government to have some explaining to do, and the government, your office, was never given the opportunity to even do that, because the district judge just jumped ahead and said, no exhaustion. So why isn't the prudent thing for this court to do to send it back down so that the normal process can occur here, the normal adversary process, where the government, if you believe that Mr. Morton still needs to exhaust and didn't exhaust, then you get to make all these arguments to the district court that you never had a chance to make. You're making them to us now, but we're not the trial court.
I understand, Your Honor. I don't have an argument as to why.
So I assume you would make the argument that after the status conference, he sat on his hands, didn't do anything, he didn't poke, prod, file mandamus. There's all kinds of things you could argue that you never got a chance to argue.
Yes, Your Honor, that is also true.
Would we take into account the fact that we are here 3 more years later and still nothing has happened?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Morton filed his habeas on April 3rd, 2020.
And that would stop any action in
I don't think it stops any action in the Charter Child Habeas Court. It's not vertical between the two.
Right.
So he could have listened to the district court and filed the habeas. He could have followed habeas court rule 2.
But why didn't the Superior Court look at the fact that he's finally federal habeas? Whoops. I guess we better move this thing and deal with his case.
I'm not as to whether or not the Superior Court was aware of the student assistance.
Well,
so,
even if it's not aware of the federal habeas, it's aware that it has a case sitting on its docket that is growing substantial quantities of loss.
Right, and this is why, and even to the district court's credit, it was concerned about at the time and said, file a mandamus. The district court was aware that in the Virgin Islands, this is something that would prompt the Supreme Court, put it on their radar screen and say, hey, look, this is the Superior Court, you need to act.
Is it your understanding that the Virgin Islands Supreme Court is pretty effective at using the mandamus remedy to get the Superior Court to move cases along?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so again, if we send it back, make that argument, right? You never get a chance to make that argument.
Not the district court, Your Honor, no.
You've made that argument here as to mandamus being the proper remedy. I guess I'd like to understand, in light of our own case law that says that we shouldn't require petitioners to go to extraordinary lengths, or they don't need to take extraordinary measures to exhaust. And mandamus, of course, is an extraordinary remedy. How could a requirement of mandamus ever come into play as opposed to just, the normal appeal process?
Well, Your Honor, mandamus is an extraordinary remedy, but mandamus is a less extreme remedy than what Morton proposes here, which is to ignore federalism, ignore comity, ignore the well-settled jurisprudence that holds that a state or territorial court should get the first full round to consider the habeas petition before the federal court excuses the exhaustion requirement.
But we've said comity is a lesser concern when the state or territorial court has had the opportunity to address the issues. And here these issues were before Superior Court. It just didn't do anything for years. And even getting the status conference, took a year of after that request.
But the Supreme Court has not had an opportunity to consider this case. And that was the purpose of the district court's basically dismissal for failure to file a mandamus. It was to, hey, put this on the Supreme Court's radar screen. Give them an opportunity to see that this case is out there.
It's been effective. My question to you is that something that we should be countenancing? Is that rationale really appropriate to say that what's required in the normal course for exhaustion is for a petitioner to go to the state Supreme Court and seek a mandamus petition? That if there's a delay of years and years in, say, the state Superior Court or the territorial Superior Court, that without having sought mandamus, that the petitioner hasn't exhausted.
It may not be appropriate for the entire circuit, but it certainly is in this particular case, under the facts and circumstances of this particular case, in this particular territory, something that
was reasonable for him to do.
Yeah.
You're not asking for a per se rule.
No, Your Honor.
That mandamus must be sought.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
But you would say in this territory, what makes this different?
I would say maybe the agent of our court system, just customs of the territory, the district court knew this and went straight to that, and
even Supreme Court's about what, 10 years old now?
At this point, 13, 14 years.
Okay. So part of this is growing pains?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. I have two quick things. Most of the case law exhaustion that we have in our court is pre-EDPA. Is there any reason that case law would not still be good law on this issue? I mean, you deal with these issues every day.
Right. To the extent that, EDPA places burdens on successive petitions and so forth, and statutes of limitations, although that's been told in this particular case.
But specifically exhaustion and exceptions, there's no new standard, is there?
I'm not aware of one, Your Honor. I can check and file supplemental if you wish.
That's right. Secondly, the case that you did mention that was out of circuit in 1960, whatever.
Yes, Your Honor.
What the name of that case again?
Barksdale, B-A-R-K-S-D-A-L-E.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood you.
Okay. And so just to sum up, I would submit that this court should not excise the Virgin Islands Supreme Court from the consideration of this very, very serious habeas corpus petition and exhaust remedies, because that's what's going to happen here. If it does, any type of evidentiary hearing will be remanded back to the Superior Court. Any type of appeal up the chain from a decision there would go through this court to the United States Supreme Court, and the Virgin Islands Supreme Court would be basically cut out of this entire process. And that's not something that we want here in the Virgin Islands.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clement. I will hear the final from Mr. Lane.
Your Honor, as my colleague suggested, this is a serious exception to forget comedy and have the federal court review petitioner's habeas petition. But what is more serious is that the petitioner is alleged he's being incarcerated and held in violation of his constitutional rights. And the writ of habeas corpus is considered the most important of all writs. It's called the Great Writ. So I would suggest that
the Great Writ is accessed after fully giving the state court system, including the highest court in the state system, the opportunity to rule on it first, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And the territorial court has had that opportunity.
Within the Supreme Court of the Virgin Islands has had that opportunity in this case?
Of course not, because you can't go directly to the Supreme Court. You have to go through each level of court here, one trial court, and then directly to the Supreme Court. But there's if the first level of court never rules on it, you can never get to the Supreme Court. Filing a petition for mandamus doesn't fairly present your claims to the court. It's a separate action that says, hey, I fairly presented my claims in trial court and they won't do anything about it. I can't get to you if they don't do anything. Make them do something. But look, within a year, approximately a year after the petition was filed, it was fully briefed and the court had a motion for judgment on the pleadings that would have ended the case if it ruled in the petitioner's favor. As soon as that happened, the ball was in the court's court. The court did nothing about it. And let's not forget that in the year between that and the petitioner filing the motion for a status hearing, the court could have ruled on it. The court could have issued the writ and set a briefing schedule, but it didn't.
If the writ of the Supreme Court had, a superior court had ruled, what would be the next step?
Had ruled on the motion for judgment on the pleadings, or?
Had denied relief.
If the motion for judgment on the pleadings was denied, I expect that the court would have issued the writ and set a briefing schedule.
Denied habeas relief.
Oh, if that was denied outright with just on the merits.
Right.
Not for some procedural foul. Error.
On the merits.
Then I suppose he would have immediately appealed back to the Supreme Court, Virgin Islands Supreme Court, and gone through the ordinary course.
So should we think about the writ of mandamus here in the Virgin Islands more like an appeal than, say, a state court system where it's a decision, a delay at the level of a common pleas court or the district court where there's an intervening appellate court?
I think doing that is tantamount to finding that the process is ineffective under B, Roman 2. I think saying that in a particular jurisdiction, you're required to have a next level court order the trial court to do its job is...
No, that's not what Mr. Clement argued. I asked him that question about a per se rule, and he specifically said, we're not seeking a per se rule. We're asking the court to look at the facts and circumstances of this case and conclude that it was not unreasonable in this case on these facts for this petitioner to have sought mandamus. Are you arguing for a per se rule in the other direction, that no court could ever say that on the facts and circumstances of a case, mandamus should have been sought?
I don't have a proper hypothetical where that could be held. I think it probably could be, but I think more important to consider is I can't imagine a circumstance where there's been an inordinate delay and the government would say, well, you don't have to file mandamus. I think that if there was held that mandamus was required.
Well, an easy case would be where somebody filed one mandamus petition and it never got acted on. I mean, how many get the file? You know, there are many ways to show breakdown in the system.
Well, never can't be determined because that means you're waiting forever.
Good,
which is exactly
good point. Excellent point. But you file a mandamus petition, it sits for an inordinate period of time, to use a word. Do you have to keep filing them? No.
I don't think you have to go down that road. I think you should look at what's happening in the court that has jurisdiction over the matter. And that's exactly what happened here. He got the status hearing. got an order on the record that something was going to happen and never did. So how long do you wait? And Your Honors, I believe that based on the circumstances of the issue, it is well within this court's discretion to end petitioner's suffering and waiting and give him the review he deserves in federal court. In the alternative, I think there's no question that this court should reverse and remand for a hearing to allow the state to attempt to meet its burden, which is not an easy burden to meet, to excuse the order of delay. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Leader. Thank you, Mr. Clement. This argument was particularly illuminating. Thank you. The court will take the matter under advisement.